Welcome back for another helping of oysters, clams, and cockles. I'm Ross Boland, joined today, as always, by my buddy Mr. Barrett Dudley to bring you the best TV shows and movies weekly in an easily digestible podcast packed with laughs. Barrett, how's the closet today? Is it a little warm in there?
Just slightly. You know, we're heating up weather-wise.
Oh, yeah.
The temps, they are a-climbing. That's a famous quote from Bob Dylan, I think. And, it's okay, though. It's okay, though, because I just got in from Academy Sports and Outdoors. Inflatable pool. And along with that, a pump, an electric pump to inflate the thing.
Ah.
So I'm locked and loaded for this Memorial Day weekend, baby. You know what I mean? I'm gonna be in my kiddie pool, getting my bronze on.
Now, is the kiddie pool more for you or the dog?
Oh, it's most definitely more for me. But the dog is welcome to splash around in there as well, because she needs a bath. She is on a crash course for bath time this weekend.
It is getting hotter here in Texas, Barrett. Yeah, hope everybody in the Clam Fam is holding up well. We have a ton to discuss today. We're closing out Amazon's 000 Season 1. We're also closing out The Last Dance, for real this time. We're also talking about some streaming services with some news and some funny stuff. And then it's on to the real reason we're all here, the most important reason anyway, Nicolas Cage's top 5 movies.
Yeah. I'm very excited about the podcast today. Just there's a lot on the list to talk about. We obviously saw the conclusion of Last Dance as well as the conclusion of 000.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some fun stuff to talk about in regards to the entertainment industry at large. We got to hit touch on this Quibi situation. I finally watched Ford versus Ferrari this past weekend, and while doing so,
oh shit,
I noticed just that what got us onto the Nicolas Cage topic, and that there's a bunch of weird movies trending on iTunes for either no apparent reason or some various reasons that I can point to. On top of all of that, the rest of the internet is finally taking our lead this week, and
they
talking
are.
About Game of Thrones again, because this is the week that it ended. And man, we've been here. We've been done that. Know what I'm talking about?
Dude, I thought it was pretty interesting to see how people were, everybody suddenly was trying to, it was funny. I saw some tweets that were like, this is the anniversary of the ending of Game of Thrones, and not even one person has suggested rewatching the show. And I was like, excuse me, there are dozens of us, dozens on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles and the Knights Rewatch. Actually, there's hundreds and hundreds of us. And no, man, we've been doing this for weeks and weeks. We were prepared, Barrett, you see.
Yes, we were. I thought it was interesting because when I clicked around on Twitter, it was trending topic, there was a hashtag, etc. The reactions were still so overwhelmingly negative.
Yeah.
And I could just tell that people had not gone back and revisited.
Exactly.
And were only playing off the emotions that they were left with at the conclusion of the season last year and the hubbub that followed.
But very unfair.
Yeah, you know, and I just would suggest that they go to patreon.com/oystersclamscockles and join up so that they can hear our rediscovery of the show, which probably had its best episode ever this past Friday.
Yeah, we did episode 5, The Bells, this past Friday. We're doing one episode every week in April and May. Obviously, last month being April, this month being May. We're closing out this week on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles. You can join, though, for the remainder of the month and still access all those podcasts from the last 2 months to get caught up if you want to do a rewatch of Season 8 of Game of Thrones with us. We've done a rewatch for every single season. They're all available right here on our feed on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and SoundCloud. But we are closing out the Knights Rewatch final season on Patreon. A lot of that's due to the economic circumstances surrounding just the podcast industry as a whole, and we just found this was going to be the most effective way to make sure that Barrett and I could get it done for y'all and not have to worry about advertisers with your direct support on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles. That's essentially how Patreon works. It's a platform that allows you to support your favorite podcast in exchange for ad-free Knights Rewatch content right there in April and May. And then next month, Barrett and I will find a whole new mess of stuff to watch and discuss with y'all on Patreon, which we'll be announcing at the end of the month here. Good stuff, though. Great stuff. It's been phenomenally fun so far rewatching season 8. I would say that I have fallen back in love with the series in a way. For those of you who are still very negative and down on it, I highly suggest you join us and get a whole new lease on life, Barrett.
Yeah. You know, it's going to change your whole perspective on shit.
It really is. It really, really is. All right, let's dive into 000.
Let's talk 000. Yeah.
We closed out season 1 with the final two episodes. And rather than, I mean, doing them even episodically, let's just talk what we saw here.
Yeah, yeah. Episode 7 was what I'll call the sex ep, because our boy Chris gets one small slice of life, falls in the span of 48 hours, falls in love with a local girl, goes to a sick discotheque with her.
Really dances. Where it is on
and popping. The dance scene was hilarious because it, like, they were in like this, like, you know, Euro style, Vegas style club, but it would have appeared that they were like dancing to like a rock and roll music. It was so strange.
Yeah, I couldn't really get, like, I was like, okay, are his moves supposed to be like goofy white guy moves, or is it but with a touch of like, I do cocaine, or is it like these are his moves because he's sick? And the fact that I even had to ask that question is literally problematic and offensive.
Yeah, it was weird because you've seen that, how many times have we seen a club scene, right? And so they... Mm-hmm. They start with like that cool shot where they're looking down on Emma, who is clearly like lounging because she is on one.
She's high as fuck, yeah.
She's high as fuck, and you kind of expect it to be like really sexy, and maybe like you hear that like the thumping bass that you would expect in that club, and yeah, based on what she's doing, and yet then we pan up to everybody just like dancing as if it's like Huey Lewis in the News playing a live show or some shit. So there was some dissonance there in the dance scene. But yeah, that is what I took away from the episode. Chris, he allows himself to love, and it was his big mistake, Ross. It was a big, big mistake.
You know, Barrett, they say it's better to have loved and lost than to not have loved at all.
That's right.
This episode argues otherwise. Chris, but thank God Chris in this season has perhaps one of the least enjoyable arcs in terms of how much fun he gets to have and how much good stuff happens to him in the history of television. It is just a nonstop shitstorm with this
guy getting the shit kicked out of him. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, just brutal. And as he falls deeper and deeper into this genetic disease that his mother died from, that him and his sister both know is something that's going to greatly impact the rest of his life. Yeah, episode 7 was the one where we got him to have a little sexy time. And then it's all downhill from there. Because I watched the finale this morning. And when are you supposed to watch this show?
He's dead at the end of episode 7.
Yeah, which, by the way, did you have any doubts about his life or death status going into 8?
Yes, yes, I did. I thought that, I, to be completely honest, I didn't totally think he was dead. I thought he was going to be saved there.
Yeah, when they showed him the pool of blood around his head.
Yeah, I was just about to say, although when they do that, when you see that in a TV show or movie, when the blood starts pooling, by the way, do TV and movies love anything as much as they love blood slowly pooling around a body?
Blood?
It's just, like, they're obsessed with that, with somebody being on the ground, and then, like, that little cue, right?
And the slow spread of the puddle around their head.
They love that shit. But, yeah, so that was disconcerting, because that is usually the sign. That's usually them telling you that somebody has died. Jon Snow getting stabbed, for example.
Yep. That was too many pounds of the head into the ground, Barrett.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, yeah. When Ross, you're supposed to watch this show when you have forsaken, due to circumstances and your, I guess, your gaming life, You have forsaken,
there are many circumstances involved.
You have forsaken actual TV watching time. But this is, you watch it in the evenings, like a normal person.
Here's the thing. I was going to say, like, I don't even know when you're supposed to watch this show. Because I did the finale in the morning, and frankly, it was a terrible, terrible mistake. Just a lot of darkness to absorb at, like, 10 a.m.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of dead bodies.
But when you watch it at night, like we've discussed, then you need a chaser. At least I have, like, the chaser of a day.
Yeah, that's true.
With
that's
sunlight true. Outside, you know?
Right. Right.
Like I can go outside and look around and I'm like, it's not real, Ross. It's just a TV show. When I watch it at night, then I just go to sleep and I think about the vampires coming for me.
Yeah. So, let's move on. Let's talk about, well, how did you feel about that seventh episode? Did you feel like the ship had been righted at all, or was it still shaky to you?
I thought that they had gotten a little bit back on track. And when it was all said and done, to kind of discuss, you know, to kind of bring in our discussion about episodes 5 and 6 and how we were a little perturbed by the way things were going, I think it all wrapped up enough. Here's kind of my conclusion about this season. They weren't going to do as much as I thought they were. So it was a lot of it was set up for 2 as well. Like, and which is something I didn't really consider. I don't know why, but like, obviously, the vampire takeover and our boy Manuel ending up on top in Monterey or wherever the hell they are at the end.
Yeah, Monterey. Yeah.
People are dying everywhere. That's a huge setup for season 2. He is now, like, I don't know if he's completely taken over Mexico, but he's taken over enough of it to where he is now the dude that's going to be moving 2,000 kilos for the American girl to ship to Russia.
Yep.
Now he's the dude in Mexico. So that was very much a setup. And that whole scene at the end, you know, with her sitting there on that couch, first of all, worst birthday party of all time for that child or whoever's birthday that was.
I was both appreciative, but also shocked that there wasn't more child death at that birthday party. I thought they were just going to light up the entire party, to be completely honest.
The second our boy, like, okay, these vampires, Barrett, they trained super, super hard. We made fun of them for like going into their training ritual, and we were like, what is this? They're doing jumping jacks and shit. Like, these are fat guys from the street. Like,
yeah,
we saw them doing jumping jacks, and now they have a fully automatic weapon.
That's right.
There must have been a lot of training going on off screen, because these fools are an elite combat unit. And the second I noticed them like moving in, like, first of all, they've got all the silencers, they've got all the gear they could possibly need, but they've got hands on shoulders and shit, and they're going in pro. Once I realized that, I was like, ah, the children should be okay. Because see a freaking crowd of kids and you're like, oh, he's just going to empty a clip into these children and I'm going to have to watch. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, that's not what happens. It's more tactical. All the adults, though, they're gone.
No mercy for the adults. No mercy for fat Lara or skinny Lara.
They both get a couch, though, to sit on in the afterlife.
Yeah, they do. They do. Look, you're right. They go in tactical. They're a well-oiled combat unit here at the end. I still have a problem with how unathletic all of these shitbags are. Outside of like of Manuel, who kind of looks like he could actually be like, you know, a stone cold military trained killer.
There's like one other guy left still who looks like he'd be badass too. The dude with a shaved head or whatever, who's a real little guy.
Yes, yeah.
But most of them, you're right. They're regular motherfuckers.
And so my question for you, and not to drop this segue, too early, but I'm going to anyways. Is it more shocking to you that none of the vampires outside of the two that we mentioned have an athletic bone in their body? Or is it more surprising that nobody in Michael Jordan's family or extended family or progeny or anybody related to him has an athletic bone in their body?
I think the latter. Honestly, I like the angle in 0000 where it's like, these are regular dudes recruited off the streets of Mexico to go do war for drugs. Yep. Michael's family makes no sense to me at all.
We'll get there. But we're
going to The Last Dance right after this, and we're almost
shocking.
Done.
Anyways.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about, last episode, I actually... You know, I asked you the question, did 7 write the ship for you? I was still a little, it was better, and I didn't hate, like, I just thought it was a little bit, I liked the relationship between Chris and the girl. it was just so quick that it made it feel a little sloppy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was almost like, here's the thing about it that I sort of, that sort of registered with me, like everything about these, the happenings in these first six episodes really points toward things not ending well. Mm-hmm. And you get the impression that like Chris and his sister have registered that too. Like this is a mess, man. The fact that they're still alive at all is frankly a fucking miracle.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like, yes, it happened a little quickly, and but I think that you have those like weird moments, especially when you're in such a mess, like where if you mm-hmm. connect with somebody like that, it can be so powerful, you know what I mean? So it's like we got that night for him where he got to have fun.
Yeah.
And it just sort of also showed, though, like if you're going to be in this business, you can't let your guard down. You really can't take risks like that, sleeping with the daughter of a dude who's your connect in this area. Like,
yeah.
Yo, that was a mistake, and it's right. one that they pay for pretty immediately. The other thing is, like, I was not down to watch this man slowly degenerate until he dies. I understand I got plenty of the impact of Out of the Suffering and all that shit from this season. I didn't need several seasons of that. I'm really grateful to not have to endure that, frankly. Yeah. I also like what the death of his character is going to do to our main girl.
Yeah.
It clearly hardens her in a way that is necessary for this business. Things operating between her and her brother at the same time were not good. They had too much conflict, and I think she'll finally like take some of the things from his personality and his perspective that she was a little combative with that we saw, and instead apply them. She's going to be a great leader, it looks like.
Well, so yeah, so let's trace this into the finale, into episode 8, which I did think was very good. And you mentioned that a point that I'll expand on, which is that not a lot was going to happen, basically,
mm-hmm.
as we wrapped things up. Obviously the Vampiros take down the Leras and install themselves as the head, so that was kind of the big action piece and the largest amount of movement. But I liked episode 8's simplicity. I liked that they didn't try to do too much, and they finished up each of these storylines in a way that made sense to me and that had a kind of a natural ending point. And then I just really thought what they did with that final scene where Emma shows up to the, you know, to the house in Monterey and is absolutely unfazed by everything going on. And just like sits in between those two dead bodies like she's done it 1,000 times. I just thought that was all very well executed as like a finale, as a cap on this season. And I guess I would expect them to do season 2, but they don't have to. Like it works either way.
Oh,
basically.
They sure are.
But that was great. And I also like, it was so, I loved how they had Manuel, who's still learning, come sit where she was just sitting and like do the lean that she was doing.
Cause he's like, trying to figure out how to be a boss. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Here's what I loved about the finale to all your points as well. It said a lot without doing a lot. And a lot right. of what it said for me was, here are the sacrifices that have to be made to, you know how everything always glamorizes and romanticizes the drug business and Scarface right. and Blow and, this was pretty gritty, man. I mean, this is what you have to be willing to sacrifice if you're look at what everybody endures. The American chick, she's not quite hard, evil, bad enough to make this work. The whole fucking season is a mess for her. She has to lose her brother to become what I think we see in this final episode makes her like the hardened boss lady that's going to be necessary to run this organization. Don Mino, he starts the season in a cave in the ground. Makes this deal for this 900 and whatever million dollars worth of cocaine so that he can reestablish himself and come out of the cave in the ground. And in order to do that, he has to sacrifice his grandson. The person who's equipped to actually be in this world is Manuel. He's already psychotic enough. He has everything it takes from the psychosis, from the fucking sociopath side. what he needs is the business mind of like the, so that's what was so great about seeing him take that position on the couch. Mm-hmm. But like, he's already a crazy person, right? We see him go like greet this baby into the world and then tell the mother, "I murdered your husband." Like, this fool's as hard as it gets. So it just shows you like, here are the elements of a human being necessary to do such an, to do a career engrossed in evil and death and like crime. That shit was powerful.
Yeah, it was good. And I liked how they wrapped it up. Yeah, it very, very intense with the on the Italian side of things, which we haven't really mentioned because there wasn't, again, there wasn't a lot to happen, it basically, except for what's-his-face to get knocked off.
The grandson.
Grandson. But yeah, to have to kill your son and then also kill your son's son...
This guy's having a rough time.
Jeez. I mean,
now he's hanging with the great grandson,
and now he's hanging with the great grandson. Who? I mean, look, I've seen a lot of movies and TV shows, man. You don't let the son of dads that you've killed live very often.
Godfather Part Two is essentially
it's a recipe for disaster because that kid's eventually going to find out what you did, and then he's going to come for your cabeza. I guess in Don Minu's case, he probably expects to be dead by the time this kid is of killing age.
Now, here's the thing: Godfather Part Two, which I don't think you've seen, but there's a
no, I've seen. Oh, I've seen.
Oh, good, good. Well, the part where at the beginning where Don Vito, or young Don, whatever Corleone. His mother goes to beg for his life to the Don of the area. And the man says like, nah, sorry, the kid's going to grow up and then he's going to come after me and seek vengeance. And obviously he escapes, and not a spoiler alert or anything, but like, yo, that dude was already old too. And it still did not pan out well. Like Robert De Niro came back straight up, gutted this fool across the chest. Like, so yeah, but I think you're right. This kid's, he's like six, man. Don Mino's going to be dead and gone. He's barely moving around at this point.
Right.
One of the things I question is like, what's the situation over there? Because this guy clearly is not long for this earth.
Yeah, and who succeeds? I thought that just as far as plot, as far as story, I wasn't sure. Look, grandson, whose name is just Stefano.
Stefano.
He really got put in between a rock and a hard place, which again, probably one of the messages of the show is that if you are involved in this, you will be left with decisions that are that result in your death one way or the other. But that's what he had, right? Like he got in between the two sides and then was basically forced by the rebellion into going against his grandfather again. He didn't have a choice.
No, like, not really. Once he had put himself in the position of betrayal, it was over for him. Yeah.
Yeah. So then he's got to go, and of course, Granddad already knows because he's back in control, and everybody's got their little birdies around. So I mean, it was over for him as soon as his original plot got foiled.
Watching all these different dudes, you know, these families, that's always one of the fun things with these mafia style, organized crime style deals, like these other families trying to make moves and then it all failing for all of them. Like watching them all get wiped out in that last episode was really enjoyable because we'd seen them do so much evil shit, like holding these women and children hostage and whatnot to try to make their stuff happen, beating the crap out of people.
Yeah.
And then they got theirs.
Yeah. So it really did. I did think it came together there in that finale. I liked a lot of the scenes that we got, and I hope they do a season two.
Yeah, I'm extremely excited for the potential of season two. So I really hope they do it. The main chick, whose name is also always slipping my mind, Chris is Emma. The only one I remember. Emma. I think that's a very promising character set up in a way like that. Really, it's got us in a good spot for season two. She really reminds me of the main big lawyer in Ozark. For those of you watching Ozark. A lot of similarities in sort of personality and like that bad bitch attitude in their hair as well. Anyway, I thoroughly enjoyed season one of 000. It definitely wasn't what I expected, Barrett, in terms of the way it was sort of, they did an original enough job to where it was a lot different than any of these other drug narco style shows or movies that I've seen. And I like the setup. I think it combined a lot of different elements from a lot of different things we've seen to sort of make a new version of it. And I love the characters so far. It would have been nice if they had given us a little more like levity, but there's none in this show. It's just pretty, there is none.
Yeah.
There is no laughter or smiling. It's almost all terror and horror.
Look, there are some genres and topics that just don't allow for that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you think about the show's contemporaries, whether it's, now I've not watched Narcos.
There's a lot of light moments in Narcos.
Yeah. Okay. But there's not in Sicario, for example.
So there's the two angles, right? And I'll say Narcos is the more glorification, romanticization angle. This is not that. Like, they weren't going to put those lighthearted moments in because they're not trying to show you, cool this is. They're trying to show you, hey, this is really fucked up.
Yep.
Yeah. Where would you put season one on a scale of 1 to 10? For me, it ended somewhere like around like, because our boy that recommended, one of the many people who recommended the show for us, Thomas, he said that it was like a B plus A minus, right?
Yeah.
All said and done for him. I'm going to say B minus B plus for me. Mm-hmm. Like, it ended in the B range somewhere, but I think potential-wise moving into season two, like, I'm more excited for two than I was to watch one, because one was such a cool setup for two.
Yeah.
And I think there's potential here, so I really, really hope they go after it. I think they will. I don't know why they wouldn't. I don't know how the numbers did on this show. But Amazon seems to have all the money they need.
They do, yeah. And I mean, this show was, it was buzzed about a little bit. I don't know how popular it ended up being, but... It is definitely one where I could see them, you know, upping the budget a little bit and giving them a little bit more freedom. Yeah, it fell right in that B, solid B range for me. I thought that the last two episodes bumped it up pretty close to B, B plus range. And yeah, I'm looking forward to see what else they do with it. I would say my one hope for season two, I'd like them to sprinkle the double angle gimmick out. Let me see it like three times a season in an 8-episode season. I don't need it every episode.
Yeah, it's like they found it in like the third or fourth episode or whatever, and they were like, oh, we have to do this every time.
Yeah, which was a little weird.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'd like to see that a few times a season.
Yeah. But yeah, that's what I got.
I would also like to see like the not-so-shitty side of Italy at some point. Like, we're seeing all the cool parts of Mexico and the shitty parts. Italy, it's just like... caves in the desert, like
yeah. I didn't look up to figure out the geography of where Calabria is in relation to any of Italy's major cities. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that you mentioned that, because in watching these last two episodes, I was struck by the fact, I was thinking about how most of Italy is still very much, I mean, it's like, it's earthy, it's farming. It's a lot of farmland
like that.
Yeah, it's, I don't think, I know that these terms are the other countries that don't fall into the quote unquote first world don't love them, but Italy, I don't believe, is considered a first world country.
There's a lot of underdeveloped little areas like that.
Yeah, now I could be talking out of my ass there. Maybe I don't actually know. My point is that there is a lot of Italy that is very rustic still.
I think it is well, this question gets asked a lot, according to Google.
Yeah.
Is Italy second, or third world country?
Yeah, those are outdated terms, I know, that not a lot of countries don't really fall into anymore. So I don't really know. But my larger point is that there's a lot of Italy that is still just kind of rural.
Yeah,
I guess is probably the right word.
I'll also say this: if you did a show that involved, like, you know, somehow the meth cooking of West Texas or some shit, people would be like, "Man, areas of Texas are really underdeveloped still."
Yeah, yeah,
because it's fair just enough. Fucking farmland out there and dudes doing meth. Like,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Yeah, no, there's very much like there's. I think when you think of Italy. In your head, you think of like Paris, and you think of France. You think of the developed cities, the really
Rome
beautiful,
and Milan.
Yes,
and,
the
yeah,
most
yeah,
famous
yes.
areas possible.
Yeah,
you don't think
totally.
Of the farmland. You don't. That's like when you think of Texas, you think of Dallas, you think of Houston.
Yeah, and the other thing about Europe is that, and this is one of the ways that it differs in comparison to the States is that it's so much older that there are just like ancient buildings all over the place. Like, we don't have that.
Nah.
We just don't have that. We don't have like those rural farm country stone houses that are like, I don't know, 300 years old or whatever they are.
300
like,
year old dilapidated fucking stone
that just
farms.
That doesn't exist. Everything is it's just hasn't, there's nothing that old here basically.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So I'd like to see some more upscale Italy, if that's the request that I might make.
All right, yeah, let's get a bottle episode at the Pity UMO fashion show.
Exactly. All right, moving on. Last Dance with the Last Dance, for real this time. Again, the last two episodes of The Last Dance actually aired this Sunday. Barrett, you brought up Mike's family.
Yeah, I got two big things about these final two episodes. The first, let's jump into that. This is something that I think I've known about I've kind of been adjacent to like kind of having this sense that Mike was the tallest person in his family. His dad was not tall. His brothers are not tall. One of them played basketball with him in high school, but they were not prominent athletes. And then they finally had his kids do some small interviews in these final two episodes where they kind of got to lay their tracks down, if you will. And it just struck me again, like, dude, Mike is an aberration in that gene pool, man.
He's just like, I mean, that's usually with the best of the best athletes like this, we see multiple members of their family have been pro, their father played, whatever. Like,
yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. I remember at one point one of his kids getting into college somewhere to play, and people were like, ooh, Michael Jordan's son. And then, like, he wasn't very good. And people were like,
it wasn't very good.
Okay.
I don't even know if it was a scholarship. Like, and if it was to some, like, yeah, and I don't think it was a D1 school. It's really strange. And I mean, look, not everybody that has. Sometimes it almost works like that. Like, if you are the best of all time, there's just something that it's just like, it's almost like it just scientifically
comes out of nowhere,
live up to in anywhere close to that. Like, I don't know if LeBron's kid's going to be any good. He's all right, but he's playing on a team, his like high school team. He's like the eighth best player because he's at a school that is just, you know, a pipeline for
the best of the best,
the best of the best. And he's not the best of the best at his current age. But yeah, then in other spots, there are plenty of people that just have those family bloodlines where like they're all NFL players or whatever.
Right. JJ Watt. It's like every single one of his brothers and him are on NFL teams. Like, it's
exactly
ridiculous.
Exactly. So it's just kind of striking to see MJ's family. Just nobody really. I mean, nobody's 6'6". Nobody is.
Yeah. Now, what did you think about his family? What did you think about the fact that, first of all, like we talked about last week, it's a little strange that we don't get any of Mike's kids, that we don't get any of Mike's baby mamas, that we don't get any. Like, we get a little in the last episode, finally. But it's not like they're talking about Mike as a dad, in light of Kobe's death and the way it framed everything up with him as a family man. You know, you really got to think the lack of that here is very telling.
Yeah, I thought it was certainly. I thought it was telling. Not so much the lack of the kids. I could kind of understand a little bit. The lack of significant other, wife, girlfriend, kid's mom, whoever. I thought that was interesting. And I mean, it is what it is. Like, there could be a multitude of reasons. Either the director or MJ didn't want that angle, or those women may not have wanted to contribute. Like, it could be any number of factors. As a whole, I don't think that not having that piece of it took away from the story at all. If anything,
No, and I think
it said plenty by not being a piece of the story, really.
The story is about this last dance for the Chicago Bulls. Yes, it's about Michael Jordan, but it's The Last Dance is the title for a reason.
That's a good point.
They weren't trying to delve into Mike. Look, this was the story of his athletic career, and I get that. I'm just saying, it was a bit off-putting almost to only get his kids a little bit in the final episode. And like the stuff they spoke to, I was like, okay.
Yeah, it's unimportant really, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. But all in all, I was happy we got something from his kids. It would have been strange to not have them at all, just because of the scope of people interviewed here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like to not have any of his family would have been very strange. So yeah, I mean, what else stuck out to you the most from these last two installments?
So there's after they beat Reggie and the Pacers in the Eastern Conference Finals,
yeah.
Mike goes to the locker room and puts on what can only be described as the suit from The Mask.
Yes.
It is huge and it is yellow. And then he calls Larry Bird a bitch and says, fuck you.
fuck you.
I wished he had had a matching yellow hat so that he could have gone full mask with it.
Smoking. Somebody stop me. Somebody make that meme for us, please.
But that stuck out to me. And, yeah, man, I just, the Steve Kerr story was, geez, I'm mixing up my whys. The Steve Kerr story was interesting. I liked that piece of it. I'm glad that they included that. It was good, man. It is fascinating to look back and know that a sports team in 1998 was like, nah, we're not going to run it back. We just won 6 out of 8. Best player in the world was just the best player on the best team again. And we just think it's time to rebuild. So we're pulling the eject button.
Yeah, it was one of the first times in sports we saw what was a dynasty sort of dismantled at its height, where everybody's going, wait, why didn't that work out?
Yeah. So that now it's one thing that the show does not really cover, again, because it's not that relevant, although it kind of is. That next season was the strike shortened season,
mm-hmm.
which I think played a factor into the lack of it made the off season feel really short because teams and players and owners and management were not communicating because they were locked out. The leaders of those two sides were, you know, negotiating basically.
Right.
And then it all just came together in a snap and the season was on. But had that been a regular off season, I feel like it's way more possible that Reinsdorf and MJ sit down and talk and figure out a way to at the very least bring MJ back and try to put together one more run. But yeah, man, it great documentary, great timing for the documentary to be available to us. And I'm one of my favorite things of the year so far.
I'm going to say, my last two thoughts were what a thankless job Jerry Krause had, this poor bastard. Nobody got made to look worse than the GM of the fucking Bulls. And this documentary, what it really did all in all, was remind me what was so fascinating about Michael Jordan and what made him such a cultural icon and why we all respected him so much and why we buy the damn shoes and why everybody's so obsessed with him and his run. And it's because we're inspired by greatness and the drive to succeed. And very few people walking the earth in our time, our lifetime, have had the drive, the will, and then had the success that Michael Jordan has had. And one of the things that I took away from like his lack of a family story in here sort of was like, that's the sacrifice, man. This in the same way we talked about what you have to sacrifice if you want to be a part of the dope game on the level that the people in fucking 000 are. If you want to be Michael Jordan, do you think you get a normal family life? No, that's the sacrifice. That's one of the many. And I thought it was super cool to see sort of Michael in these more emotionally available conversations, like where he was him, right? Or at least a version of him that was more open than we've ever seen.
I definitely think that he was him. I think that for all of the talk about Mike having control over this documentary,
yeah,
this could have been way more of a
biased piece. Yeah.
of a biased piece than it was.
I agree.
There are plenty of opportunities here, and plenty of people have taken them to say that, like, oh man, like Mike's not a good dude. Like, you know, we don't like him.
He kind of took the opportunity to say, like, look, I don't really give a fuck.
Exactly. And guess what? He probably really doesn't.
Clearly really doesn't. Dude, somebody, okay, so you know the story with him and Chamillionaire, right? Where Chamillionaire asked him for a picture and he got sunned really, really hard. Mm-hmm. Somebody put out a picture of Fabolous, the New York rapper, with Mike yesterday, and people were like, oh, like, rest in peace, Chamillionaire. Like Fabolous got the photo and Cam couldn't. And one of the comments was like, nah, man, Fab paid for that signed jersey package with the two. Anyway, it just, like, you know, it's like one of those things where with Kanye and Yeezy, I think it was a similar deal. Now it's gotten weird because Kanye's gotten weird, but, and that's the thing, he hasn't maintained. Mike's brand control, his image control, is unparalleled in terms of the way he's crafted that thing. And it's because you think Michael Jordan, you think his Airness, you think that little Jumpman logo. What do you think about? You think about the best. You think about greatness. When you think of Yeezy now, that's not what you think about. You think about Kanye's crazy ass.
Yeah,
Mike, you think about rings, trophies. You think about on stage with the commissioner. That's passion. What you think about.
Yeah. It is also just what you're saying here folds into the fact that he is a genre defining icon of a person. He changed everything about an element of our lives, sports, that is still holds true today. Like, our athletes now are international celebrities because of what Michael Jordan did for the game.
And as a result, they're all compared
to him. And was able to do with his brand. Keep in mind, there was no social media then. The internet was in its infancy. Like, the fact that he achieved the level of recognition, fame, success, brand identity, like, all of that with no worldwide web, basically, with no smartphones, with no Instagram, is incredible. And that still holds today. Let's touch on the other. I cannot believe I almost forgot this. My biggest, like, squealing in joy moment was that Leonardo DiCaprio was at Game 6 in Utah and then has a moment with Mike after the game in the locker room. Holy shit, that was incredible.
That was another one. Like, the Seinfeld moment was cool. This one was somehow even cooler. Just because it was
that's Leo like 6 months after Titanic, man.
Like, the two hottest possible people speaking to each other,
or actually, a year after Titanic.
Well, Leo, since Titanic, he's been Leo. Yeah,
he was at the that's Pussy Posse Leo, man.
Yes,
that is. There are a lot of things that are cool about being Leonardo DiCaprio, and a lot of reasons that we like this guy and think of him and this, you know, as an icon, and a lot of the ways that we do with MJ. This just added a layer of jealousy for me.
Right.
Like, even at 21 years old or 22 or however old Leo was there in 98, he was a big enough sports fan to realize that this was a game that he needed to be at. And he made it happen. And we know he's a basketball fan. He's courtside at the Lakers games and is going to take Jack's seat eventually.
It's one of the few places we see dude.
Right. And but just the fact that he had the wherewithal that is serendipity right there, man. That Leonardo DiCaprio was at that game and then gets to go talk to MJ. Tells him it was poetic. I mean, you can't make that shit up.
Yeah, and my last takeaway from The Last Dance, and I'll leave y'all with this question, is to your point about the social media stuff and how much of a testament it is that he built that pre-social media stuff, is you know, was that a positive? Like, would Michael Jordan have gotten to that iconic level today if social media gave us the exposure to all the inner workings of his personal life in the way that it does for our, say, LeBron James? Because Mike was so not camera friendly and so unpolished and so rigid and such a dick, would it have played in the same way? And that's the most interesting aspect of his whole thing to me. That's from episode one of this doc that I started thinking about, was like, Does Michael Jordan exist if this happens in the social media era? And I don't know.
Right.
Or would it be even bigger? I don't know. It's just a crazy thing to consider.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, moving on from The Last Dance, this episode of OCC is brought to you by Bespoke Post. If your mailbox is anything like mine, 90% of the time it's a fairly depressing place with political flyers and utility bills and unholy amounts of coupons. But once a month, I do have a reason to be stoked, and that's because of my box of awesome from Bespoke Post. Everything I get in my box of awesome is always dope. I love Bespoke Post. They send guys only the best stuff every month. No matter what you're into, Box of Awesome has you covered, from styling, grooming goods to barware, cooking tools, outdoor gear. Box of Awesome has carefully built collections for every part of your life. Right now, a couple of my favorites available are the Switchback, which provides you with everything but the tent that you need to survive in the wild, or the Forge, perhaps, because you must stay strapped with a good knife in times like these. It's Damascus steel, and you don't even know what that fucking means. To get started, take the quiz at boxofawesome.com. Your answers will help them pick the right box of awesome for you. They release new ones every month across a ton of different categories. It's free to sign up. You can skip a month or cancel at any time. Each box costs only $45, but has over $70 worth of gear inside. Get 20% off your first monthly box when you sign up at boxofawesome.com and enter the code DRAGON at checkout. That's boxofawesome.com. Code DRAGON.
Yeah, I heard that George Martin actually based Valyrian steel off of Damascus steel.
That's always what I've been told too, Barrett.
That's what I've heard. So just know that if you get Damascus steel, you essentially have the keys to the kingdom.
Of course.
Also, the $70 thing, that's no lie. I got the Shine box.
Shine.
Got a great pair of shades.
Yeah.
And I looked them up afterwards. I was like, oh damn, if anybody wants to know what these are, I mean, Shine box on Bespoke Post, but I gotta know how much they cost. They're not available for just by themselves for anywhere under $100. So that's the type of value that that you get with this stuff too.
And on top of that, if you use the code DRAGON, you get 20% off your first box, boxofawesome.com. All right, Barrett, you said we'll call this our streaming services segment.
Yes.
You wanted to talk Quibi first, and I want to ask, what the hell is Quibi?
Quibi is a $2 billion project that was going to bring a streaming service exclusively to your mobile phone, and every show on it was going to be no more than 8 minutes in length.
Okay.
Now, I'm speaking of all of this in the past tense. It all still very much exists and is available. The timing of the release, as I'm sure you can figure out, could not have been worse. They released the point of this, and God, they spent money. I mean, like, name a celebrity, and they probably had a show or some type of thing coming to Quibi.
Okay.
And Anna Kendrick and Chrissy Teigen and, like, just a million other celebrities. You could very clearly see where the budget was going, because they had Liam Hemsworth has something on there. I mean, they're, like,
They really went for it.
Packed with celebrities and movie stars and just, you know, in entertainment figures signed on to put content on Quibi. Here's the thing. Everybody has a ton of time right now, so nobody is in the need for little small doses of television shows. The second thing is, now that this has been, you know, kind of a botched release, a bust, it's already being called. Their numbers are not good. It's not looking good.
The fact that I didn't know what it was does not bode well.
No, and I'm shocked, because they were definitely advertising it in places, but that does not bode well if you did not know.
No, for real, that wasn't a joke.
What Quibi was. What's been really interesting is the dissection of the concept in the first place, even without coronavirus. Look, there was a great point made, you know, in the aftermath here, that if I'm watching, because Quibi was originally exclusively for your phone, if I'm watching a show on my phone, what am I supposed to use to scroll all my other apps while I'm watching something?
It's very problematic, dude.
And that's a joke, but it's so true. Like, half the shows we're watching, we call them phone shows, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I've got it on, but I'm looking down at my phone. I'm checking Twitter. I'm scrolling Instagram. I'm responding to an email. I'm texting on the group chat. Like, I'm not dedicated 100% to the show.
Which is a problem. I mean, it's a problem, but it's also, Barrett, like, I even get to the point where it's like, even on a show where I know it's not a phone show, I still have my phone near me, and every probably, you know, I don't know, max 20, 40 minutes or so, I'm reaching over and I'm checking the fuck.
Yeah.
And if I'm on the phone watching the show, I can't do my compulsive psycho 2020 human checking shit.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have problems.
So that was also an interesting piece of it that they didn't think of. So they've changed Quibi so that you can now access it on desktop.
Oh, that was fast.
Yeah. But it's just it's a weird thing. Like I don't take it as a point of pride that we are essentially the generation that made everybody's attention span like
trash.
You know, that of a hummingbird.
It's not great.
Or a moth, you know, like I don't take pride in the fact that we have made it so that we need 8-minute television shows in order to keep people's attention.
And we spend 8 hours on our phone a day.
Like, that kind of sucks, actually.
It's a huge bummer, so, yes. The same thing happened with, like, think about, like, internet writing, man. We went from, like, you know, people don't even do long, thoughtful pieces anymore because you can't get people to read them, so you have to do short shit.
Yeah, yeah. So it's just weird. Like, I was never interested in this because I wasn't interested in the idea of an 8-minute show in the first place.
And oftentimes, you know, the 20-minute shows we watch, I'm like, oh, I could have had more of that.
So it's just, you know, and I'm the guy that's sitting over here talking about how every movie is too long, but the 8-minute doses, I wasn't sure that was interesting. I wasn't sure when I would watch that, even if I'm supposed to be like on a lunch break at work. Like, that's, I'm doing other stuff. I'm looking at that. That is my moment to check social media or to scroll through email or to, you know, get on a shopping app or something like that. You know what I mean?
Were they thinking like people would watch it exclusively when they poop or something? Like, because that's also my scrolling time.
It was supposed to be like short breaks, commutes.
Like, I'm going to go have a cigarette and rip a Quibi show real quick?
And rip a Quibi show real quick. Yeah, something like that. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I wish them well. So, it seems like it's not going to end happily.
It's been a disaster, and in light of it struggling here out of the gates, it's kind of been subject to this very quick postmortem. And I feel like people are just realizing like everything that was wrong with the concept in the first place. So I'm not sure how successful Quibi is going to be or even how long they're going to be around.
Oh, Quibi. Which brings us to our next topic. You hit iTunes to rent what?
Yeah. So this past weekend, I hopped on the Apple TV.
The old Apple TV.
Because I had a night to watch a movie. And I finally was able to consume Ford versus Ferrari. But what struck me was that given our current situation and you know, kind of our lack of new movies coming out in theaters, there's still plenty to rent. But the shows, the movies that were trending near the top of the iTunes movie category, there were a lot of throwbacks in there, Ross. Mad Max Fury Road, which I assume was trending because of Tom Hardy's Capone, is straight to on demand, so you can rent it right now. Already, it's out,
and it's being panned, right?
Not very good reviews, yeah. And then Nicolas Cage is Gone in 60 Seconds, a movie that stands out in my mind as just like resonating with me as like a teenager.
Uh-huh.
Like, I was probably there was nothing more exciting than seeing Nicolas Cage and Angelina Jolie in on the big screen stealing cars for 90 minutes. I mean, that's a 14. They definitely had a 14-year-old involved in like the pitch meeting for that movie.
Because the sexiest thing in the world was at that point was driving.
Yeah, yeah, right. And Angelina Jolie with dyed blonde hair. So I just saw that on the list and I was like, God, that was such an awesome movie that meant so much to me when I was that age. Made me think that what we're going to talk about here in just a second, we got to do Nick Cage top five.
Yeah.
I think that one was trending because Nicolas Cage has been announced as the Joe Exotic lead.
He will be playing in Tiger King.
In one of the adaptations. And then another movie that was up there was Enemy of the State, which, again, if we were to do Will Smith's top five, which we should at some point, that movie is probably going to be there because that was an awesome movie that just like hit all these awesome notes in 1998 or 99 or 2000, right there whenever it was released. Also hilarious to look back on, because the entire, that was supposed to be like a very futuristic, hackery, sciencey computer movie. And the idea behind Enemy of the State was, you know, radical in 1999, but that your technology, the toys that you picked up, your phone could all be tracked to follow you by the government. Laughable now. Absolutely laughable. Like, yeah, somebody can know exactly where you are, what you're looking at, and what you're doing at all times of the day throughout, you know, just your entire life at this point.
Yeah.
Like, they know exactly where you
are. The premise for that movie, the trailer, if it ran in 2020, everybody would be like, yes.
Yeah, wait, why is this scary?
What's the part about, why is he upset? Why is he upset? That's all of us?
So I was just very much enjoying looking back on these, for whatever reason, why these late 90s, right around the turn of the century, right around the millennium, there's just a crop of movies trending from that era. And that era is just, look, when you are 14, 15, 16 years old, that is when movies really, really like, they just sink.
They're larger than life.
You know, it's like a mama duck. What's the word I'm looking for?
Lays an egg.
No, they like shit. My vocab's failing me here. They imprint.
Ah.
Like baby ducks. They look up and their mother imprints on them, and they know that it's mom.
Okay.
Movies do that to you when you're in your adolescence. They imprint on you.
You watched Enemy of the State and went, that's mom.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I've noticed, dude? It's funny because, like, you gotta remember, the general populace is the same group of people that makes these Adam Sandler movies that aren't good huge successes financially. Mm-hmm. So what I've noticed on the iTunes, like, trending section and the movie section in there, I feel like it's mostly idiots renting stupid shit. And here's why. Why in the name of God is anybody in there paying money? And I know a lot of the time it's because they're like, these are in the $4.99 sec, or this cheaper $1.99 to rent Enemy of the State or whatever. And so they get trending because they're, but bro, we all have Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and HBO. And like, yo, there's a ton of free movies from these eras in those different streaming services. So you have to be really specifically craving, like, you know what? I really want to watch Gone in 60 Seconds. And then it not be, for me anyway, it would then have to be not available anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And then I'd have to go see it on there. And then I'd have to still be stupid enough to go, I'm going to pay for this.
Which
is not beyond the realm of possibility. I'm just saying. It's kind of crazy to think of.
Those movies, the fact that they're trending, I would be willing to put down money that they are not available for free on the other streaming services.
Which is still strange, though. It's like, what? Who, that many people were paying to rent 1990s action flick Gone in 60 Seconds? I guess, was it early 2000s?
I'm confusing it now. I believe that Enemy of the State was 1998 or 99, and Gone in 60 Seconds was 2000.
It was the year 2000, yes. It's just crazy to me. But also, I have done this where I'm like, I can't find this anywhere else. This is exactly what I have to watch right now. And then I go into iTunes, and I've even done the stupider version, which is like, you know, a movie, you have to watch it right now. You can't find it anywhere. And then it's not available for rent, and it's $19.99, and you're a little high and you're like, fuck it. I've even done that. So I own the stupidest collection of movies in my movies thing. It's like Godfather Part Two, Fifo Goes West, like Minority Report, and like one other movie. There's just the most random collection in my little movies thing on my Apple TV app. Now, this did bring us to what is going to be our final discussion point today.
Yeah, I should.
Nicolas Cage's top five movies.
Let me quickly. I know we're coming up on the edge here, but I will just say, because people have at
you're edging.
I'm edging. Yes, right this second in the closet. People have wanted us to talk about Ford versus Ferrari.
Yes, they have. But I didn't know you were watching it this week.
Yeah. Do you want to watch it and then talk about it?
I I have to watch it. Like, my mom will be so pissed at us if we talk about it and I haven't watched it.
Okay, let's save it. Let's save it then.
Because she's been like, this is going to be one of your favorite movies. Like, you have to watch it. I just am waiting for a good window, like you found this weekend, to like do the like take a load off and enjoy it thing, because we've heard so highly of it that it's like, I don't want to fit it into a crowded day. Sure. So give me the rest of the week. I'll find a day to watch it and we can discuss
it. Yeah, we'll talk next week. Sounds good.
Ford versus Ferrari talk finally coming next week. Okay, let's quickly do our Nicolas Cage top five movies. Now, let's first just say, Nick Cage is a guy that went from, like, in our youth, Barrett and I's youth, one of the great action stars and A-list celebrities in the United States of America, and not just in the United States of America. One of the things that made Nick Cage so successful was that he was an international star. You could almost say, like, in the same area as, like, guys like The Rock or Jason Statham or those dudes who sort of, like, they find this appeal worldwide.
Absolutely.
And their silly little movies are huge, 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 huge hits. Cage was one of these dudes. And then he had this very strange situation, like, where he kept – first of all, people figured out, like, this guy's kind of a shitty actor. Then he had this trouble with the IRS when people found out he was, like, buying golden toilets and stuff like that because he owed, like, $30 million in back taxes or something. And he went through this like 10-year period where Nick Cage became sort of a joke.
I feel like we're still in that period.
Well, now, Barrett, we're very much back in that period as he has been signed on to play Joe Exotic. But he sort of popped out of it for a second and people tried to like give him the benefit of the doubt and he almost like did this Keanu thing.
Yep.
But then no, it's back to like Joe Exotic world. But he's had one of the stranger careers in terms of like A-list celebrities falling into the Z-list jokes territory, doing the worst movies possible after having a run where he was one of the highest paid actors in the world.
He is
of anybody we've seen.
He is a strange, strange cat. And I mean, that doesn't even begin to describe it really. But like that, you look at this IMDb with 104 credits and it is so all over the map. We talk about how his acting is the butt of many, many jokes. One of maybe the best YouTube videos of all time is the
Nicolas Cage freak out montage.
Yes, is the Nicolas Cage just screaming in all of these movies that he's been in.
I think it's called Nicolas Cage losing his shit montage.
Yes, Nicolas Cage losing his shit. If you've not seen that, go watch it right now. I mean,
you will cry laughing.
Yeah. At the same time, this dude's been nominated for 2 Best Actor Academy Awards, man.
People forget that.
Like when he has been on in some of these films, he's been on. And he's a strange man, and I don't really know what else to say about him other than that.
That's all I have to say about
that. One thing that sticks out to me is I was in New Orleans 10-ish years ago for a wedding, and maybe it was only 8, I don't know, who's to say. I did a ghost tour. There's this one very famous house in like the French Quarter.
Okay.
That both Johnny Depp and Nicolas Cage have owned at one point. It's super, super haunted. And that's just like, you know, he's the guy buying ghost houses in New Orleans, man. You know? Johnny Depp was the one spending $30,000 a month on wine. Nick Cage is the guy that is buying ghost houses in New Orleans. Like,
and golden toilets.
It's no wonder these dudes are running out of money, man.
And that all said, he has some good movies.
Some great movies.
I guess I'll start with my number 5.
Okay.
It's Wicker Man. And here's why. It's among the most entertainingly bad things I've ever seen in my life. The scene with him screaming, not the bees, not the bees, is one of the more iconic moments of the Nicolas Cage losing his shit montage YouTube video. It's sort of what that movie, like, because I saw the YouTube montage, right? Then I was like, well, I have to go watch the movie with that scene. And then I watched the movie and it was so bad. And I was laughing so hard. There's a several minute period where he runs around in a bear costume punching out women. And it's just like, you're like, how did they even like explain the scene to him and then say action? And like, then they actually did this scene. Like, it's just one of these movies where you, first of all, it was a remake. Like it's like they took a respected movie and they made it into a cultural disaster. And it's just Nicolas, it's like prime it's just a perfect example to me of like what this man's career encapsulates at this point. Like, we've got a stupid idea. Let's stick Nick Cage in it and it'll be fine. And then he just shows up like, not the bees, not the bees. So my five is, of course, Wicker Man. What's your five?
Can I ask you a quick question before we go into the...
Oh, sure.
Did you look at Nick Cage's IMDb page to do this?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I want you to scroll down from the top and tell me the most recent Nicolas Cage movie you've seen, and then I'm going to give you my five.
The most recent one I've seen? Like, that? You mean in terms of it's come out the most recently?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, let me get back on his IMDb here. There's no H in his name, by the way, if you're trying to do what I'm doing right now. Okay, Untitled Joe Exotic Project. Jesus God.
Just look and figure out the most recent the one that came out the most recently that you've actually seen. And I'm going to tell you my five here.
Okay.
So, my five is The Rock. This movie 1996 started the run. Well, actually, it didn't start the run. It started the action run, but the credits run. 1995, Leaving Las Vegas. That's the first one that he was nominated for an Oscar for. Then in a row, and this was the action movie run that is, I mean, you take these three movies, you put them next to any three in a row of an actor, any other one, going to be hard to beat. It went The Rock, Con Air, and Face Off, back to back to back. I mean, that's just an incredible run.
Yes.
And it speaks to this era of the 90s, which is, by the way, which is totally, almost totally gone. Not a single one of these movies got a sequel. All of them were based on comic books. These were just straight up action movies that people were like, no, it'd be cool if there was like a thing of nuclear balls that like almost creates nuclear holocaust in the world, and it's on Alcatraz.
Oh, shit, bro. Yeah, the cast in that one is like insane, too.
All three of the plots for these movies are insane, and yet they're all so good that each of them is on my top five.
Yes, The three you named, two of them are in mine. The Rock is my four.
Okay.
And Con Air is my three.
Okay.
Okay. Those are both great classic action movies. I just did what you asked, and it's hilariously ironic, but my number five, The Wicker Man, is the last Nicolas Cage movie I saw, and it came out in 2006. So that's 14 years.
Really, really wild, because he has done so much since then, too.
I mean, he's done 30 movies since then, it looks like.
Yes.
At least.
Yeah.
I'm not joking. Like, I'm scrolling through. I think it's 30 movies before, and I haven't seen a single one of them.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not counting like Grindhouse. I think he had like an uncredited fucking.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't see World Trade Center or The Weatherman. Like, you know, I'm like, Wicker Man was the most recent. There's 40 freaking movies after that, which is nuts. My number two or three, sorry, my number two. So five is Wicker Man, four The Rock, three Con Air, and then I'm going Lord of War. Okay, love the gun running movie. Love his I love his cocaine addicted brother in Lord of War. This is one of those ones where it's the romanticization and, you know, like, well, bad things happen too, and it's really rough for him. But there's a lot of jokes and lighthearted shit in Lord of War. And then my number one Nicolas Cage movie of all time, and it's not really close. This is his defining movie for me that I love, and I actually watched it last week, again, for like the 40th time, is Raising Arizona. Raising Arizona is the perfect, it's like, there's dumbass action scenes, him robbing stores and such, yeah. But it's mostly like him getting to be full-blown, hilarious, silly comedy Nicolas Cage in this very kooky, quirky, weird comedy from my childhood that I just remember watching over and over with my dad, and now it's like I've seen it as an adult, and yeah. It totally holds up. Love Raising Arizona, so that was my number one.
Well, and you know Raising Arizona is a Coen Brothers film.
Yeah, which makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's right up their alley. It does get overlooked every once in a while because it came out in 1987. I mean, it's, you know, it's very old.
It's the year I was born.
I remember Raising Arizona because I probably watched it when I was in college at some point and I liked it. It didn't imprint on me. And so I can't totally remember a bunch of the scenes. And that's the only,
it wasn't your mom.
That's the only, that's the only reason it doesn't make my top five. I know that that's one of his better movies. But I have to go with Nick Cage classics on my top five, which is
of course.
My number four is Face Off. It, two of the most insane actors to ever live in John Travolta and Nick Cage, literally facing off against one another whilst wearing each other's faces.
If you've never seen this one, kids.
Again, this one just had like the names of with Castor Troy and Pollux, and the going off the stars, the constellations, Castor and Pollux, like that was crazy. Like the two golden guns that Nick Cage carries around, the prison that Nick Cage finds himself in where like the metal boots locking down onto the floor. Like there's just so much batshit stuff in this movie. It's an all-time classic bad action movie.
Yes.
We will move on to number three here. Again, I'm just mixing up the order of these. It's Con Air. The reason that this one isn't higher, I think, is because it's such a good ensemble with Ving Rhames and Steve Buscemi and like John Malkovich, all these other guys contributing so much to why that movie is fun to watch.
Put the bunny in the box.
My numbers one and two have a little bit more Nick Cage in them. Number two is National Treasure.
Oh, wow.
Which I think is severely underrated. I think it got a lot of love at one point as like, wait, is this movie actually good?
Right.
Again, though, it has what you look for in a Nick Cage movie, which is just a completely absurd and ridiculous plot.
Yes.
But it's a lot of fun. And I would it's one of those ones that I would watch again and again. Just you tell me you want to watch National Treasure, I'm in. I'm watching National Treasure. And number one, for reasons that I've already alluded to, is Gone in 60 Seconds, because it stands out as one of the foremost movies of my adolescence. It came a year after The Matrix, I believe. I believe Matrix was 1999. But those are two of the first movies that stick out in my head as like, I was a little bit too young to be, I'm trying to think of the right way to explain this. Look, Gone in 60 Seconds and The Matrix, those movies weren't made for 12 and 13 year olds, but that's who they connect with, like in the trailer. That's who like is desperate to go see them, more so than the adults that are actually going to understand the movie a little bit more. You know what I mean?
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
And so those two movies stick out in my head as just ones where I was like, I have to see this in theaters. And I don't know if I'm going to totally get everything that I see, but these movies are resonating with my soul in a way that makes them extremely important to me.
Yes. No, I get what you're saying.
And Gone in 60 Seconds was just incredible. It's Nick Cage and Angelina Jolie, stealing cars for 90 minutes. Like I said, looking hot as hell and just doing their thing. And then, of course, it's connected to Ford versus Ferrari in a way for me, because the Ford versus Ferrari is all about Carroll Shelby. And in the movie Gone in 60 Seconds, the climax scene is Nick Cage and his baby. It's his baby car. It's his, you know, it's his one true love, the car in Angelina Jolie. And it is a Shelby. It is a vintage Shelby. And he jumps it over like, I don't know, like a shipyard or something.
Yeah.
He goes off a huge ramp and jumps this Shelby across a shipyard.
Con Air is like my Gone in 60 Seconds because it's because of the cast for that. I mean, it's a different type of deal, but that's the one that really was like that action movie. I feel like everybody has one. It's either like The Rock or Gone in 60 Seconds or Con Air or one of those like crazy action movies that's your Nick Cage favorite. And mine's probably Con Air because of the cast. It's like, listen to this. Nicolas Cage, Steve Buscemi, John Malkovich, John Cusack, Landry Albright, Monica Potter, Danny Trejo, Ving Rhames, Dave Chappelle.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it is an absolutely ridiculous cast of people. Kids, if you never saw 1997's Con Air, rather, you got to watch that as well. And that will do it for our top five Nicolas Cage movies. Make sure if you haven't appreciated all these fine works of art by the actor, known as Nicolas Cage, Nick Cage, golden toilet seat owning maniac. You have to watch
it. The most recent one for me, by the way, I asked you this question, is Kick-Ass, 2010's Kick-Ass, where he plays Big Daddy.
Yeah.
And really, that's not a, that is Kick-Ass, he is in Kick-Ass, but that's not a Nicolas Cage vehicle. So right. what I'm going to ask here of the Clamp fam is, if there is anything post 2010 on this filmography that is like a must see, either because it is so hilariously bad or because it's actually like an underrated good movie, please let us know, because look, man, I need some Nick Cage in my life during this pandemic.
Please do holler at us on Instagram at Oysters Clams Cockles, on Twitter at Clams and Cockles. We're on Facebook.com/OystersClamsCockles, and that will do it for today's episode of OCC. Huge thanks to our sponsor from today, Bespoke Post, for supporting the show. Hit that URL, boxofawesome.com, and use the code DRAGON. You can also support OCC directly and finish out the night's rewatch with us in the month of May by going to patreon.com/OystersClamsCockles. This Friday, we will be covering the series finale of Game of Thrones on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles. But if you support the show with a $5 or $10 pledge today, you will get access to all the other episodes in the Night's Rewatch Season 8. And if you join the Mollusk Militia, you get that extra hotline call episode as well, with the Mollusk Militia exclusive hotline. And the entire episode is driven by those hotline calls on that hotline. Thank you to everybody who's been a part of the Night's Rewatch and supporting OCC and making sure we can continue to do this podcast for y'all. It means the world to us. We hope you're enjoying the Night's Rewatch. For those of you who are there already, and for those of you who aren't, come through. It is a blast. We've found that more and more people were unaware we were even doing this. There's been a lot of spotlight back on Game of Thrones this week. Come through and be a part of it with us. Patreon.com/oystersclamscockles. Every episode of the podcast on Patreon is ad-free. And as we said, we're closing out the Night's Rewatch, Episode 6, the finale of Game of Thrones, this upcoming Friday.
That is right. That is right. Get on board now. If you love Game of Thrones, you absolutely need to be a part of this. And if you hate Game of Thrones because of its final season, you need to be a part of this even more so, because, like I said, you are going to be Hansel, scaling Mount Vesuvius, tripping with spider monkeys,
tripping on
and
acid,
shit,
man.
Smoking peyote.
Change your whole perspective on
and,
shit.
And changing your whole perspective on shit, exactly.
Patreon.com/oystersclamscockles. My name is Ross Bolin. You can follow me on all social media at WRBolin, at WRBOLEN. And you can listen to my personal show, The Ross Bolin Podcast, which is a comedy and humor show that's also rooted in mental health and lifestyle and all manner of topics, from animals to pirates to current events to whatever the hell I feel like talking about that day. The Ross Bolin Podcast, available wherever you listen to OCC. Mr. Barrett Dudley, where can we follow you and hear more of your voice?
I am at Barrett Dudley, Twitter and Instagram. Been doing all sorts of stuff on Twitter, conducting polls and research,
science
for the podcast in a scientific way. I requested recipes today.
I saw that. I can't help you there.
You guys are failing me so far. It's okay, though. We still love you. And then check out Club Cool wherever you are listening to this podcast. Just search for Club Cool. Give it a listen. We've had a couple of good guests on recently, so there's definitely something for everybody in there. And yeah, Ross, the results of the Twitter poll, it looks like we're going to have to address Outer Banks on Netflix.
I've seen more and more of Outer Banks talk. I'm more than willing to dive in.
Yeah, just the proof is in the pudding here, and people just love remembering when they were horny teenagers, and that's what I think is driving the desire to for us to talk about this show. Let's talk about being horny.
Love it. Love it. Maybe we'll do some of that next week. We'll have horny time. We'll all get all horned up together. Until our next helping. Adios, muchachos.